either because its bureaucrats had recognized a potential public relations nightmare in time to avoid committing it for once, or simply because no one had considered it very important, the Earth Alliance government had left Hockey Night in Canada largely alone, apart from the mandated change in its title to reflect the 2406 abolishment of Canada as a country. The only real difference was not in the coverage itself, but in the change of the national anthem played at the beginning of the game. This got another round of boos from the assembled duelists and friends, many of whom struck up their own chorus of O Canada to drown out the EA's rather bland tune. Once the puck was dropped, and the Toronto Maple Leafs and Winnipeg Jets had gotten on with the business of trying to bludgeon each other into submission, all that fell by the wayside anyway. The EA could fool with the letterhead all they wanted, but Canada was still Canada, and hockey was still hockey. For whatever reason, this contest, though of no particular note in terms of the season standings or implications for the postseason, and not waged between two teams with an especial rivalry, proved to be fast-paced and intense even by the standards of the 25th century NHL, and within minutes the whole room was rocking to the shouts and cries of the suddenly partisan viewers. One source of amusement that immediately and unexpectedly appeared was that Toronto had a player named Gerhard Kruger. This worthy's name drew a cheer every time he was mentioned by the play-by-play man, particularly when it cropped up in some phrase that was amusing when taken out of context, which seemed to happen often, because Kruger was one of the team's main playmakers, seemingly always to be on the scene whenever anything noteworthy went down. Every time it did, those nearest to Shizuru and Natsuki noticed that the former was a little more tickled, the latter a little more uneasy. This came to something of a head near the end of the second period, when one of Winnipeg's forwards went steaming across Toronto's blue line with no defenders in sight, but for the Leafs' much-harassed goaltender. "It's a classic breakaway. Svensson is flying out there!" The play-by-play man, the venerable and still wondrously excitable Professor Jim Everard, cried. "The Leafs are scrambling, caught in the middle of a shift change." Suddenly, a blue-clad figure appeared as if out of nowhere, charging up behind Svensson like a freight train and whacking the puck away from him, then smashing him into the boards with a thunderous hip check. "Taken from behind by Kruger!" Professor Jim bellowed, disbelieving. "Oh, Natsuki!" Shizuru cried, drawing her startled lover's arms tighter around her. "So bold!"
"Shizuru!"
Natsuki blurted, blushing bright red, as the whole room disintegrated in laughter. Held firmly by Shizuru's grip on her arms, hemmed in by the couch arm on one side, and an in actual tears of mirth Kaname Sterling on the other, she had no hope of escape. Nor, in all honesty, did she really want to, and could only mutter and go on blushing as Shizuru vamped a bit more. Things quieted down a little bit at the end of the period, as the commentary team brought in a couple of outside experts and spent the intermission analyzing the action thus far. After 40 minutes of full-throttle play, the game stood tied at 2-2, so there was plenty of action to analyze. Utinu was pleased to discover, when they went to the studio camera, that the color commentator on the game was that Karen Torborg, the one she'd seen playing, and decking a couple of Ottawa Senators, for the Leafs in the first hockey game she'd ever witnessed. She realized with a mild shock that that had been almost 5 years ago. The thought gave her one of the day's only pangs of discontent, as she found herself wishing that Kyuichi Sionji were here. He'd been with her at that game. They'd discovered ice hockey and their own fledgling friendship together that night. And it didn't sit well with her that he'd disappeared, not just from her life, but, as far as she could tell, from everyone's. At first, she'd assumed he'd gone on another long-range assignment for the International Police, but when she'd put the question to Griffin, the agency's chief and her own adoptive father, he'd denied it. Utina firmly doubted that he would, or even could, lie to her about such a thing, so she considered that matter settled. But that left the perplexing question of where the hell he had gone, and for what purpose. It was not, of course, entirely unknown for Sayanji to just go walkabout, but he hadn't done it for ages, and his friends had all hoped that those days were behind him now. It was one of the very few black marks on this week that he wasn't around. She glanced to her right, at Wakaba, and sighed. Wakaba gave her a questioning look. Utena shook her head, forget it, and returned her attention to the screen. She knew Wakaba was upset about Sayanji's absence, too, more so than anybody else, probably, and she didn't want to dredge all that up. Not here, not now. Getting more proactive about tracking the dipstick down after the wedding was done with was near the top of her to-do list anyway. "And I'll tell you something else, Jim," said Torborg enthusiastically, gesturing to the playback screen behind the studio desk. "Kruger has been very aggressive tonight." "Yes, she has," Shizuru purred, snuggling back against Natsuki a little more. "What in the world has..." Natsuki started to mutter under the laugh that got. Then she bit off the rest of the question and growled at herself as she realized, belatedly, that it would be daft to utter the phrase, "gotten into you tonight," at this moment. She'd stopped herself too late, though. Shizuru was on her wavelength, and didn't find it at all difficult to guess the rest of the question. She chuckled throatily, looking back over her shoulder with a mischievous twinkle in her scarlet eyes, and drew breath to reply, Natsuki was sure, with another innuendo. Something in Natsuki Kruger snapped, and, a bit rashly, she suddenly decided that, rather than let Shizuru say whatever she was about to say, it would be better to just kiss her. So she did. And a great cheer arose from those assembled, as though the Leafs had just scored the go-ahead goal, for anyone who had been paying attention had realized half an hour ago that this was Shizuru's ultimate objective anyway. That said, even Shizuru seemed slightly surprised for a moment that it had worked, before accepting it as her due and leaning into it. "There," Natsuki said decisively when she'd finished the kiss. "Now behave." "You'll never settle me down that way," said Shizuru, facing front again, and Natsuki forehead faulted against her upper back with an I-give-up grumble. "Aw, relax, Nat," said Lindsay, reaching across Konami to pat Natsuki on the shoulder. "You guys are adorable." The teenage girl sitting propped against the front of Corwin's couch in front of Caitlin, probably the youngest person in the room, looked away from the scene with a mildly embarrassed grin and a faint blush on her face, then glanced back a little bit guiltily. When she did, Cora caught her eye and gave her a conspiratorial little wink, which deepened both the grin and the blush as she glanced away again. "Cute kid," Cora thought. "I wonder whose student she is. Caitlin's, most likely." The Leafs and Jets kept at each other with full intensity for the scoreless third period, which was possibly the most exciting 20 minutes of utter futility anyone in the room could remember watching. And then for the first 3 minutes of overtime, when, in an ending that by this point struck many of those present as inevitable, Gerhard Kruger blasted in the winning goal for the Leafs. "Score! And it's Kruger getting the job done!" Professor Jim roared. "Kruger's been getting it done all night long, Jim," Karen Torborg concurred. Natsuki had, by this time, passed clean out the other side of her earlier embarrassment. Now she just raised an ironically triumphant fist in the air, and forestalled all comments by remarking, "Yes, yes, thank you, I'm amazing." People were still laughing about that when the double door to the hallway opened. The two figures standing there didn't enter the room, but instead remained in the doorway, scanning the crowd as if looking for a particular person. "Hey, you guys," said Utena, rising with some difficulty from the couch. "I thought you weren't coming until morning." She looked disappointed. "You just missed the game." Looking more closely, she tilted her head thoughtfully and added, "What's the matter?" For the two new arrivals, Hikaru Shido and Fu Hooji, two of Utena and Corwin's fellow rune knights, looked like they had just run to East Hall at full pelt from somewhere inconveniently far away. They were flushed and out of breath, and Fu's hair was uncharacteristically disordered, as opposed to Hikaru's, which was characteristically so. Fu, bent over with hands on knees and still catching her breath, didn't reply, but Hikaru managed to say, "Hi, Utena. Sorry. We were planning to come over in the morning, but is Nal here?" "Hello," said Nal. Sensing the urgency in Hikaru's voice, he scrambled around Korra's hip, up her back, and onto the top of her head, eliciting a ticklish little wriggle and squeal in the process that he would normally have paused for a moment to savor. "Right here. What's the matter?"
"We need to talk to you outside," Fu panted.
With a shrug, he unfurled his wings and took to the air, darting across to alight on Hikaru's slightly more stable shoulder. "Okay. Something we can help with?" Utena wondered.
"No, no," said Hikaru with a completely unconvincing attempt at casualness. "Nothing you guys need to worry about. Everything's fine. It's really, really fine."
Hikaru stepped back, gesturing Fu back with her, and closed the doors. Just before they met in front of her face, she grinned nervously and said,
"Good night."
There was a momentary pause as everyone in the common room glanced at selected others in skeptical puzzlement. "Wow," said Utena. "That was about as convincing as me in the same situation." "Okay, so..." Nal inquired as the two rune knights raced back up the stairs to the forest. "What's going on that's so important you had to come and drag me off one of my favorite laps?"
"Why haven't you answered your phone all night?" Hikaru snapped in not really reply.
"It's in my room," said Nal. "Does it look like I have any pockets at the moment?" Hikaru made a grumbly noise of annoyance.
"Ugh, we've got to get you a lens."
Nal shook his head. "There's too much larceny in my soul."
"Can you be serious for like 5 seconds? Hikaru demanded.
"I could if you gave me a good reason," Nal replied, a trifle huffily. "So far, all you've done is drag me out of a happenin' party and yell at me. And where's Umi? If any of you girls gets to do this kind of thing to me, it's her." He looked from Hikaru's determined expression to Fu's, which had a similar set of jaw, and it began to dawn on him that something major indeed might just be afoot.
"Oh."
"Yeah," said Hikaru shortly.
"Oh."
She skidded to a halt before the door to the forest. With one hand, she seized the handle and set the mechanisms in motion. With the other, she plucked Nal from her shoulder by the scruff of the neck and dropped him to the ground. "Now get changed. We're going back to Midgard." By the time Utena, Corwin, Anthy, and half the gang from the common room got to the dueling floor, where, disconcertingly, it was broad daylight, they found it empty and silent, the rose gate closed and dark. Anthy stood by the door for a moment, her hand against the stone, then turned and said,
"They went back to Midgard. I can reopen the gate to the same destination if you want to follow them."
Utena opened her mouth to reply, but before she could make a sound come out, Wakaba had said,
"Nah."
Blinking, Utena turned to her.
"What?"
"They've got it, whatever it is," Wakaba reasoned. Hikaru might try to brazen it out if she was in over her head and didn't want to admit it, but Fu wouldn't have gone along with that. She must figure the three of them can handle it.
"What if she's wrong?" asked Utena.
"If they need help, they'll call," said Wakaba.
She put one arm over Utina's shoulders, the other over Corwin's, and started herding them back toward the stairs. In the meantime, they obviously didn't want you guys to get too worked up about it. On the night before your wedding. Seeing that they weren't convinced, she sighed and went on. Okay, look, I will go and see what's going on, and if I think they need more backup than me, I'll call. Okay? Lensman's honor. Turning them loose, she reached into the small crowd of onlookers and dragged out Tsuwabuki. I'll even take Mitsuru with me. Hey, I didn't... Tsuwabuki began to protest. Shut up and come with me, Wakaba growled, twisting his arm slightly. Sure, he agreed. Utina directed a level, skeptical gaze at her oldest friend, then smiled slightly and said, Okay, okay, go check it out. But you call me, she added, brandishing her lens, at the slightest hint of trouble. Got it? Wakaba saluted. Got it. Come on, Mitsuru, let's ride. She glanced at the slim, dark-haired figure who had been standing next to Tsuwabuki before she'd dragged him out of the crowd. Is your girlfriend coming? She asked offhandedly. Tsuwabuki reddened slightly. She's not, he began. The girl, one of the rookie Kyoshi warriors Corwin had noticed when they'd first arrived, out of uniform, a big-eyed, fresh-faced specimen of perhaps 14, blushed slightly as well as she interjected with feigned stolidity. My place is here. A grinning Korra clapped her on the shoulder and said, Oh, go on, Izumi. See a little of the big universe. With a slight roll of her eyes, she added, I'll make do with just the other nine for a few hours. Izumi blinked, then said hesitantly, As you wish, Avatar. Okay, Anthy. Three to beam down, I guess, said Wakaba with a grin. Smiling indulgently, Anthy opened the gate and gestured them through like a doorman at a fancy hotel. Good luck. Let us know if you need help. Will do, Wakaba agreed cheerfully. Come on, you guys, let's go see what's what. Night all. We'll be back in the morning. Don't worry about a thing. Everything's going to be A-okay. And with that, and a Nixon at the chopper wave, they were gone. Said Utina dubiously. Well, I guess the show's over. Everyone trooped back down the stairs again, and upon leaving the forest, dispersed, most of them heading for bed for the last round of well wishes and see you in the mornings. By the time they were halfway across the quad, only Corwin, Utina, Anthy, and Korra remained, making their way at a leisurely pace as they chatted. Well, said Korra, that bed you showed me earlier beckons, but I think I've still got enough steam to do my evening forms before I call it a night. I've got a thing I need to do down at the tower, Corwin mused. And I'm in the mood for a good view and a calming cup of tea, said Anthy with a smile. When they reached the tower, Anthy and Utina bade Korra good night and went up in the elevator, bound not for the apartment at the top, where once, long ago, they had lived, but which was now Tsuwapaki's domain, but instead the student council offices. Corwin told him he'd join them there presently, then went down the stairs off to one side of the lift cage instead. Curious, Korra followed him down a half flight, around the 180-degree turn of a landing, and down six more steps to a large, imposing iron-bound door. When he got there, he glanced back over his shoulder with a grin and spoke seven words that, Korra discovered, still had the power to give her a bit of a thrill, because they'd been the on-ramp to good times on several previous occasions. Hey, Korra, want to see something cool? He didn't wait for her answer, having asked merely as a matter of form. Instead, he worked the door's massive iron lock without touching it, using a gesture that had a whiff of metal bending about it. The door swung open onto a darkened room, releasing a gust of warm, humid air flavored with a sharp but not unpleasant tang of machine oil. With another smile back over his shoulder, Corwin stepped into the room and snapped his fingers. Big industrial lamps blazed on across the ceiling, filling the room with white light. Cora stepped in after him and looked around, wide-eyed. They were on a metal catwalk about halfway up the walls of a very large square room, its walls the same featureless white stone as the outside of the tower. A few paces in front of them was a semicircular control panel, all brass-rimmed gauges and big black levers and knobs. Spread out across the floor below them was the biggest, most dizzyingly complicated machine Cora had ever seen. And that, given that she lived in the most populous city of a rapidly industrializing Level 5 civilization, had connections high up in that civilization's leading technology company, and generally considered herself a leading-edge kind of girl, was saying something. "Wow," she said. "Okay. I don't know what this is, but I'm impressed. Just want that on record." "This is the heart of our revolution," said Corwin. "It's a computer. You might think of it as a sorcery machine. It automates the cosmic maintenance and stability functions that the pillars of Sephiro used to have to do by hand." He put his hands on his hips and surveyed his creation with evident pride. "It's the engine that runs the world." Cora eyed him for a second, then grinned. "Oh," she said, without any evident sarcasm. "Right, of course it is." Walking to the catwalk railing, she leaned out a little and took a closer look at part of the whirling, clattering mechanism, then turned a questioning look back to him. "Did you come down here just to show it off to me?" "No," Corwin said. "That's an added bonus." He sat down on the brass stool at the console, cracked his knuckles, and turned one of the big knobs a couple of stops, then began typing on the mechanical keyboard in the center of the console. "I'm adding a small patch to the operating image." With a grin, he added, "Making extra sure we have good weather in the morning." Cora laughed. "That's cheating." "Pillar's prerogative, good weather for his wedding," Corwin replied. "So..." She turned and leaned back against the rail, her elbows resting atop it. "Is that the deal with you in this world? Are you something like me now?" Corwin shook his head. "Nah, not really. You're supposed to be a dynamic agent of balance. That doesn't quite map to any of our jobs exactly, but I think Utrin is probably closest. Me, I'm the pillar. I can make adjustments, but as the name suggests, I'm really only here to keep the ceiling up." Cora frowned thoughtfully. "Gonna be honest, that sounds like a terrible job." "Oh, it is," Corwin agreed. "It's the dullest mythical position ever invented. You're basically Atlas with a better wardrobe department." He reached and cheerfully dinged a bellhop's bell set into the upper part of the console. "Which is why the first thing I did was automate it." He typed away for a moment as she favored him with an indulgent, don't-ever-change smile, then added, "Actually, I automated all our jobs. I'm not sure the girls have noticed yet. Maybe they just think things are slow lately. Anyway, that's why we can leave for extended periods without things falling over. Otherwise, we'd have our own equivalent of the White Lotus constantly texting us all, 'OMG, it is raining fire, where are you?'" Cora snorted. "Technically, my world can get by without me. I mean, it's the nature of the beast. Years go by between one avatar's passing and the realization of the next one, and things keep running fine." She paused thoughtfully. "For certain values of fine." Corwin chuckled. "Sephiro has no such luxury, I'm afraid. The pillar before me was distracted, not dead, not even sick, just thinking about other stuff, for a few years, and the place damn near went up in flames. He finished typing, considered his entry on a display that appeared to be made of a little matrix of bronze flags, then nodded and pulled a slot machine-like lever next to it. With a satisfying mechanical chunk and a cheery ping from the bell, the machine accepted the update. Corwin switched the knob he'd turned at the beginning back to the position it had been in when they arrived, got up, and said, "And, well, I think about other stuff a lot." He grinned. Hence the machine. He locked up and went with her as far as the elevator. There, in the midst of a long, long, lost time sort of a hug, he said quietly, "Weird conspiracy aside, I'm glad you're here." "I'm glad I made it. Even if I still can't quite believe why I'm here," Cora added with a rueful chuckle. "Just the other day you were completely ignoring Maki in favor of taking apart my Sato-mobile." "I haven't changed that much," Corwin assured her. "Nowadays I'd ask her to join me." Cora gave a soft snort at that. "Okay, I can see that," she conceded. Giving him one last squeeze, she turned him loose and said, "Good night, Corwin. I'll see you in the morning." She dashed at a sentimental tear, unconsciously waterbending it into a little puff of ice crystals, and thumped him on the shoulder. "Don't run off." "No worries there," said Corwin, pressing the button for the elevator. "I'm in this for the duration. Now, if I just knew where the hell Nall ran off to in such a hurry," he added wryly, "I'd be all set." "Your friend seemed like she was on top of it," Cora said. "Besides, Izumi's young, but she knows what she's doing. I'm sure they've got things completely under control." "Somewhere." "This was not what I had in mind! Shut up and run, they're gaining!" "With Wakaba," said Corwin portentously, "that's half of what I'm afraid of." The elevator arrived. Corwin smiled, to show that he wasn't entirely serious about that, tagged her shoulder, and stepped into the lift. "Night, Cora. See you in the morning." The doors closed between their parting wave. Corwin rode it up to the council office level, went through the offices, and found Utna and Anthy at the table out on the balcony, sipping from teacups. On the table between them stood a gleaming silver Gothrian samovar, a gift from Cardan Feltz when he had first joined the council. Standing next to this was a card folded into an A-frame. Corwin picked it up and examined it. The writing on it was so excruciatingly neat and precise that at first he took it for a machine-printed font. "From the newest to the eldest, I hope this meets your satisfaction," he read. "S.V. He put the card down, walked around to the other side of the table, and seated himself. By the time he'd taken his seat, Anthy had poured him a cup of tea, which he thanked her for, picked up carefully, blew across the surface of, then sipped. Not bad at all." He smiled wryly. "The new girl's a bit odd," he mused, "but polite, and she does make good tea. She has a real gift for comic timing, too," Utna pointed out. "I noticed that," Corwin agreed. "I like your imaginary friend, Corwin," said Anthy. "She reminds me of Utna, a grown woman with the best parts of a child in her." She smiled. "An old soul with a youthful heart." Corwin chuckled. "She'd like that," he said. "Cora has a very old soul. Nobody knows the exact number, but there have been hundreds of avatars, maybe thousands, and they're... each has a unique individual spirit, but they're all incarnations of the same soul. Somehow. Or possibly the other way around." He shrugged. "Aunt Belle could probably tell you how that's supposed to work, but I'm not that kind of god." Utana looked like she might be about to say something, but before she could speak, a faint sound of music drifted up to the balcony from the courtyard below. Smiling, she got up from her seat and went to the rail, leaning against it on her elbows with her hands folded around her teacup. Corwin and Anthy joined her, all looking down into the courtyard, teacups in hands. As she left the tower a few moments earlier, Cora was thinking about hunting down that dojo she'd seen earlier to do her evening forms. She was in the habit of making the last thing she did before bed, if she could arrange it, a little quiet work with one of the many martial arts she'd mastered over her long and colorful life. This was a habit of very long standing, having been formed during her childhood training as recorded history's youngest ever practicing avatar. When she got another look at the smoothly paved circular courtyard in front of the tower, though, she decided she didn't really need to bother with the dojo part. Instead, she took off her jacket, laid it on the stone planter by the tower entrance, then dug around in the pockets and found the miniature speakers that went with her Cabbage Corp Brassica personal music player. She set the player up on the lip of the planter, next to her jacket, then queued up one of her evening workout playlists, walked out to the center of the courtyard, and began her evening constitutional. She started on familiar ground, with the slow, controlled, circular motions and sure, careful steps of basic waterbending exercises. She wasn't actually bending any water, there wasn't any to speak of in the immediate vicinity, but that wasn't the point of the present exercise. These early basic exercises were a warm-up, unwinding the various tensions of the day from her body and mind. Even a pleasant, relaxed day like today would leave behind its little cares, and slipping back into these very well-worn forms was a way of shrugging them off again. "You know," Utana mused to Corwin as the three watched Cora work, "I'm starting to wonder about you." Corwin blinked. "I beg your pardon?" he said. "Well, look," said Utana, her tone of voice, slightly at odds with her opening remark, easy and equable. "You remember the first time we went to Asgard?" Corwin knew this question was too preposterous to be anything but rhetorical, so he just nodded and let her get on with her point. "I asked you if all the women you knew were as beautiful as the Valkyrie I'd seen, who were, at that point, let's see, your mom, Vigdis, Kiana, and Laneth. And you said something like, 'Yeah, I guess.' Closer to home, you had Achka, Reyna, Dorothy, the Utonium girls, at least one of whom has a huge crush on you, by the way, you probably never noticed." "She told me," Corwin put in, "last spring." "Oh, well, good for her. That kind of thing takes guts, believe me. Did you at least kiss her?" Corwin went a little red, recalling that in fact he hadn't, but it had been a near thing. Well, no. Utana shook her head with a patient sigh. "Typical," she said. She leaned back to look at Anthy across his back. "Hopeless. He's hopeless." Anthy nodded sagely. "Entirely," she agreed, then sipped her tea and added, "Nearly as much so as you, my love. You're very well matched." Corwin chuckled. "Zap," he murmured cheerfully, offering a fist for her to bump without looking. "Anyway," Utana plowed on, ignoring the point scored, "then there's your cousin." "Mirai?" Corwin blurted. "When you and I met, and don't think I don't know where you're going with this, she was 11. "Yeah, you didn't hear the quotation marks," Utana went on breezily. "As I was saying, your cousin Kaname. She's a lot like me, you know. Enough so that I'm shocked she didn't have you walking into doors long before I ever came along." Corwin turned to face Utana, leaving his right elbow on the railing and putting his left hand on her shoulder. "Wait, where are you going with this?" he wondered, sounding a little concerned now. She smiled. "I'm not jealous, and I'm not feeling inadequate," she assured him. "It's just a thing I'm trying to explain to myself. You've grown up around all these incredible girls and women. A lot of your best friends are girls and women. And yet I'm the first one who ever made you realize why there's a difference? Without trying to, or even realizing I had for a while?" She shrugged. "Having a hard time getting my head around that lately." "Is it really so difficult?" Anthy wondered mildly. She crossed behind Corwin, putting her teacup down on the table as she passed it, and went around to the far side of Utrina, then took her arm and leaned against her shoulder. "You revolutionize people's lives, Utrina. It's what you do." "You know, she's got a point," said Corwin, facing front again and doing his best to get his left arm around both of them. Unaware of the discussion she'd inadvertently caused high above, Cora was coming to the end of her warm-up when she noticed that she had acquired an audience at ground level. Anne Cross had been on her way to the Kendo Club's dojo as well, her sword on her shoulder, when she heard the music coming from the tower courtyard and went to investigate. There, she was surprised to find Corwin's friend from out of town, Cora, doing what looked like martial arts kata to the sound of old-timey big band music. The music was coming from a small player perched on the edge of the planter by the tower door, and Anne paused for a moment to examine it. She'd never seen anything quite like it. It was obviously something akin to an iPod, that ubiquitous, ancient but curiously timeless gadget. But it was made of dark-stained wood, with shiny brass corner caps like an antique desk, and a click wheel that seemed to be made of bronze. It was connected to a pair of miniature speakers, also wood-cased, their grills painted with a stylized design of a white flower. The art style reminded her of Mahjong tiles. Having satisfied her curiosity in that regard, she returned her attention to the device's owner. Anne's low-level telepathy could sense nothing from her, but the girl wasn't surprised by that. Cora was plainly an accomplished martial artist. She'd have mental focus to spare. Right now, she was doing something that Anne took to be Tai Chi. Graceful, flowing, mostly circular movements, smooth and relaxed, being extremely particular about the placements of her hands and feet, without seeming particular about anything at all. Anne had little experience in such matters, but she found it restful to watch, perhaps even slightly hypnotic. The Tai Chi sequence, if that's what it was, and the calm, pleasant jazz track ended together, plainly not by chance. Cora stood still in the center of the courtyard for a moment, her breathing slow and regular, eyes nearly closed, perfectly composed. Anne felt an unaccountable urge to slip away before she was noticed, as though she were intruding somehow just by being there. Then a much peppier, up-tempo swing number began, and the whole tableau abruptly changed. Cora's eyes opened, twinkling slightly in the light of the courtyard's corner lampposts. She gave no overt sign that she'd noticed Anne, who was off to her left. Just smiled, a little mischievously it seemed to Anne, and when the song's 4-second opening fanfare ended, she began to move again. Her movements this time were very different. Swifter, flashier, with a definite pop at the end of each, the footwork deft and a little percussive. There were still some swirling motions, but her arms extended much further from her body, and the kicking was definitely not Tai Chi. What she was doing still looked like kata as much as dance, but for a different, more aggressive martial art. Anne wondered if it might be Kung Fu. She hadn't seen that in person before, but she'd seen it in films and always found it interesting. Live, it was even more interesting, and became more so still a moment or two into the song, when Cora got sufficiently into the groove that the pops at the ends of her moves started to include fire. Anne's eyes went wide. For a second, she thought she might have imagined it. The first few were just sharp little puffs at the ends of mimed punches and palm strikes. But there could be no doubt of that after Cora did a move that looked like a wheel kick and drew a dazzling, momentarily persistent crescent of white-orange flame in the wake of her heel. Faced with that, Anne couldn't suppress a gasp of astonishment. Cora, finally registering that she had an audience, completed the move's follow-through on autopilot, then turned to face the source of the gasp, smiling as she recognized the girl she'd assumed must be Caitlin's student earlier. "Oh, hi," she said. "Sorry, didn't see you there. Hope I didn't scare you." But as she said it, she realized that the girl looked anything but scared. She looked delighted. "Are you a pyro?" she asked. Cora blinked, momentarily parsing the world as short for pyromaniac and considering smartass responses, then realized that she probably meant pyrokinetic, the word in the big universe for psionics who could make fire with their minds. "Not exactly," she said, "but close enough for most purposes. You're Caitlin's KRU student, right? I was going to ask her to introduce us in the morning. I'm Cora." Anne nodded. My name's Anne," she said, almost stammering with nervous excitement. Then, frowning at herself, she composed herself and bowed deeply. "Anne Cross, journeyman of the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu." "Nice to properly meet you," Cora said, still smiling. She returned the bow, not quite as deeply, with one fist clasped in the other hand before her, then went to the music player and paused it. "To answer your question, I'm not a scion in the conventional sense," she said. "I come from a world where some people are born with the power to manipulate, we say bend, one of the classical elements. What you just saw me doing was firebending." She chuckled. "That's why I'm outside. Fire outdoors? Usually better than fire indoors." Anne looked slightly disappointed. "Oh," she said. "I thought... Well, never mind. I apologize for disturbing your workout." "Ah, don't worry about it," said Cora casually. "I try to do a little work every night before bed, just to keep my edges sharp. Always time for conversation." She hopped up on the planter next to her player and gestured for Anne to take a seat on the one at the other side of the door, a few feet away. "Are you pyrokinetic?" Anne nodded. "Yes," she said, "but I've never done anything like what you just did. I can set stuff on fire, sometimes without meaning to," she added wryly, "and I've figured out how to use it with a few Keiryu combat moves, but what you did looked so natural. Caitlin Sensei's taught me a lot about myself since I started training with her, but she's not a PK. I've never met another PK. So I thought for a second..." "That I might be able to show you a few moves?" Cora finished. Anne nodded, looking a little glum. "Well, I could try," said Cora, grinning. Anne blinked, looking up at her. "Hey, fire's fire, right? I'm not sure it matters so much where it comes from." She hopped down from the planter, restarted her music player, then tilted her head toward the courtyard. "Come on and let's see if I can't help you out some." "Uh-oh," Utrina observed as she, Corwin, and Anthe watched the two figures below them return to the courtyard. "I think Juniper has just discovered the Avatar. This could lead to excellence or serious injury." Corwin laughed. "Or both. Both is always an option with either one of them." "Okay," said Cora, as she and Anne reached the middle of the circle. "Here's the first stance my firebending Sifu taught me. She took up a position Anne remembered from the beginning of the kung fu-like part of her earlier workout, feet planted, front knee bent over her foot, back leg straight with the toes pointed forward. Her right arm was drawn back along her side, with her hand in a loose fist. Her other arm was outstretched and slightly bent, with an open hand, palm outward. Anne did her best to mimic this stance. Cora nudged her back foot until the toes pointed a little further forward, prompting a mild protest from the tendons in Anne's ankle, then resumed the starting position herself. "Now, this is a simple move, usually the first one firebenders are taught," Cora went on. "Don't try to do it yourself yet, we'll get back to it, but for right now, just watch what I do." Moving quickly and with a taut economy of motion, she took a step forward, her foot flowing in sort of a reverse crescent motion along the ground, and essentially switched the positions of her arms, drawing her left fist in and thrusting the right forward in a fast, fierce punch that ended with a snappy turnover of the wrist and fist. With an audible thump, a puff of flame shot out from her strike when it stopped, traveling a couple of feet before dissipating. "Now you try it," she said, resuming her starting position. Anne considered what she'd seen for a moment, then copied the movement as best she could. It was a little sloppy and a little hesitant, but she thought it decently executed all the same. "Not bad," Cora said. "You have good instinctive form, and maybe a little martial arts training?" They grinned at each other. "Try it again." With a nod, Anne returned to neutral, took the ready stance, and threw another hard, choppy punch. This time the movement was smoother. "Good. Put your hip into it a little more, though. The power should come from your center, not your shoulder." Anne tried again. It felt better, like Katsujin Kenryu Kata when she was starting to get it. No fire happened, though. She glanced at Cora, who told her, "It will flow more when you get it right. Firebending is less constrained. You're fighting yourself. Don't tense up so much. That's more like earthbending." Anne tried it again, focusing on her hips and the motion of her center. Smoother still, and this time it felt much less choppy, but there was still no fire. She wondered if she should be giving the fire a little mental push, the way she did when she was trying to ignite something. The next time Cora said, "Again," she tried that, but what she got wasn't a puff of flame at the end of her arm. Instead, she managed only to set a lower branch of the tree across the courtyard on fire. "Oops," said Cora cheerfully. Without appearing to give the matter conscious thought, she made a gesture with her hands as if shaping something spherical, then thrust her open palms forward. A gust of wind rattled the tree's branches, blowing out the small fire Anne had set. At Anne's startled look, she grinned and said, "Airbending." Anne looked impressed, but puzzled at the same time. "I thought you said your people could bend one of the elements." "Aha, nice catch," said Cora. "Most people back home aren't benders at all. Maybe 1 in 100 is born with the gift. But you're right, the ones who are born with it can only bend one element. Historically, it seems to depend mostly on where you come from, though that's changing as Dicho, that's what we call our world, becomes more cosmopolitan. But there's always one person in the world, the Avatar, who has the potential to master all the elements." She smiled wryly. "This time around, that happens to be me." "Oh," said Anne thoughtfully, and then, "You must be important." Cora laughed. "Some people think so," she admitted. "It gets pretty heavy sometimes, you know, real fate of the world type stuff. But I'm just a person. I sweat and suffer and doubt myself sometimes, just like everybody else." She shrugged. "I learn, I teach, I do the best I can do. That's all anybody can do. Doesn't make me special." "Now," she said, moving briskly on, What was different about that last one? Anne explained about the mental nudge she'd given her power, which had produced the unexpected, but, she noted ruefully, not exactly uncharacteristic, effect. "Hmm," said Cora. "Okay, I'm going to make a couple of assumptions here. Stop me if I'm getting things wrong or making you uncomfortable. You're pyrokinetic and, from the looks of you, human." Anne nodded. "That must have made you a pretty hot property, no pun intended. I've tangled with the Psi-Corps myself a time or two. I'm not their preferred flavor, but they don't know that to look at me. Sometimes I meet one who takes airbending for telekinesis, for instance. How old are you? 13? Another nod. "How long were you on the run?" Anne looked at Cora as though she were the psychic one. 2 years, she said. Cora nodded, not smiling now. "Your first experiences with your power must have been terrible," she said. "Fueled by fear and anger. Painful and scary." Anne nodded slowly, her eyes huge. "Fear and anger will power firebending," Cora mused. "For a while, during my predecessor's tenure as Avatar, our world was out of balance, and the going wisdom was that they were the prime constituents of the fire within. But they're not. They're shortcuts. Cheap imitations." She touched Anne's forehead gently. "I think you know that, deep inside, and it's holding you back. You strike me as the kind of girl who prefers to do things right or not at all. And you know, your instincts tell you, that the way you first met your power wasn't the way it was supposed to be. That makes you unwilling to really engage with it. Makes you feel like it's something that has to be contained, chained down inside you." As she spoke, she started moving again, in a very slowed-down version of the first kung fu-like kata Anne had seen her doing. After a moment, Anne began moving as well, imitating the maneuvers to the best of her abilities, feeling the rhythm within them. "The thing is," Cora went on, "real firebending isn't about fear or anger. It's about inner drive, hope, life. Fire is the element of power. It's the only element that's alive in its own right. Real firebenders pretty much carry the sun inside themselves wherever they go." Still matching her slow, purposeful movements, Anne smiled slightly. "I like that," she said. "The key to real control in firebending is breath," said Cora. "The moving around, the muscle part, my old Sifu called it, that's just steering. You draw on the fire in the first place with your breath. Breathe deeply in through your nose," she demonstrated, "and slowly out through your mouth. Good. Get a rhythm going. Not too fast. The goal isn't to hyperventilate. You'll know it's the right pace when you can feel your inner fire glowing on the inhale, like a forge when the smith pumps the bellows." She wondered why Anne smiled slightly at that simile, but passed it by and continued instructing. "Don't force it. When it clicks, you'll know." They kept going, moving faster as the pattern repeated, and Anne got more comfortable. She was a quick study, and Cora was enjoying the impromptu lesson. It had been a long time since she seriously attempted to teach a novice-level student anything. The White Lotus had long endeavored to keep such aspirants at bay, insisting that the Avatar's time was far too valuable to be squandered on the teaching of beginners. She added that to the list of things she'd have to remember to ignore them about when she got home. The next time they got to the place in the pattern where something like that flowing punch happened, in this case it was an open palm strike, the two were moving nearly in sync, and both launched little fireballs a short way across the courtyard. Ha! Cried Anne, delighted. I did it!
Way to go, said Cora, giving her a high five that turned into a hand clasp. Not bad for a first attempt. You've got potential. With a little work, you could be a first-class firebender. Even though I'm not really one at all, said Anne, feeling comfortable enough now to go for mild sarcasm. What you just did was fiery and bendy enough for me, Cora told her. Anybody has a problem with that? Hey, I'm the Avatar. She shrugged. They gotta deal with it. Anne laughed at that, then yawned, covering it with the back of her hand. Sorry, she said, a little embarrassed. Cora's response was to perform the kind of colossal yawn that put Anne in mind of Sergei settling down for a nap. Nothing to be sorry for, she said with a smile. I don't even know what time it is for me. Interdimensional jet lag. She grinned. School's out for today. Sifu Cora has to get to bed. Anne glanced at her watch, blinked at it in dismay, then nodded agreement. Definitely bedtime. Are you staying with the rest of the gang in East? Cora asked. Mm-hmm, said Anne. I'll walk over with you then, said Cora. She put on her jacket, stopped her music player, packed it and her speakers up in her pockets, and the two of them started walking toward the distant dorm. I always liked firebending, said Cora conversationally as they crossed the quad. Which is weird, because I'm a waterbender by birth, and avatars usually have the biggest problems with their opposite elements. But no, I had my big block about airbending. I guess I just gotta be me. You do seem like that sort of person, Anne agreed with a small, crooked smile. Cora glanced at her, then giggled. Master Tenzin, my airbending teacher, said it was the element most closely opposed to my personality type, which I suppose makes sense. She smiled a wistful, nostalgic smile. He always used to say I'm stubborn like an earthbender. Your world sounds amazing, Anne said. It has its moments, Cora agreed. Sometime after the wedding's done with, you guys should come visit. I've been trying to open the place up more to the outside galaxy for years. It's slow going, but I think I'll have more backup once Maki and her gang file their reports on this visit, she added with a grin. When he gets a minute, I'll talk to Corwin about setting it up. He and I have a lot of lost time to make up for. She grinned again. There's a firebending academy in Republic City, where I live. You could take classes. You and a couple dozen other firebenders around your age. I bet that'd take away a little of that alone against the universe feeling. A couple dozen? Wow. I think I'd like that. Well, then, we'll have to see if we can make it happen. If Caitlin's okay with it, of course. I don't want to steal her student, said Cora with a mischievous smile. It's bad form. Anne laughed. I think she'll be up for anything that decreases my chances of burning the house down, she said, then agreed. But it's only polite to ask. They reached East Hall, then. Anne's room was upstairs, so they parted in the stairwell just off the front vestibule. Thanks for showing me what you did tonight, said Anne. It was really amazing. Not a problem, said Cora. I meant what I said. You've got potential. She put her hands together in a different gesture than her earlier enclosed fist bow, open hand upraised atop the opposite fist. This is how firebenders salute each other, she explained. So you won't forget your first teacher, she added with a wink. Good night, Anne. Anne imitated the salute, smiling. Good night, Sifu Cora. Anthy, Utina, and Corwin got back only minutes after them, and didn't have as far to go once they parted in the hall. After their first wedding attempt had ended in chaos,
Utena and Corwin had decided that it would be silly to repeat the traditional pretend-you-don't-know-each-other rituals of the evening before the wedding. They were sleeping apart, but only the width of the hallway apart, not in completely separate areas as they had on Babylon 6. He kissed both women goodnight, told them he would see them in the morning, and retired to his single room, pleasantly weary and, unlike last time, entirely pleased with the day. "This time, we're going to get it right," he thought as he climbed into bed and drifted almost immediately off to sleep. No backsies. Where the hell is Nall? Utena stood at the window, looking out at the campus of her namesake academy, for a few moments after changing for bed. It was the same view she'd had from this window many, many times before, in the old days, when life hadn't always made sense, but had always at least been interesting. She decided, not for the first time, that nostalgia was overrated. She much preferred life as it was now. It still didn't always make sense, and it was still always at least interesting, but nowadays it was so much more fun most of the time. She turned back and laughed quietly at the sight that greeted her. It was their room, their old room, the same as it had ever been. Anthy in the lower bunk, Choo-Choo sacked out in the top drawer of Anthy's desk, and the upper bunk awaiting Utena, covers drawn back, pillow plumped just so. Back in time, except without all the stupid parts brought back. Utena bent and kissed Anthy's forehead. "Good night, Anthy," she said quietly. "Are you nervous?" Anthy asked, not really in reply. "No," Utena replied truthfully. She climbed up into her old bed, drew the covers up, and turned on her side. "I probably should be, but I'm really not. I guess I got all the angst out of my system the first time around. Now? It's all good." She laughed. "Maybe Earthforce did us a favor after all." "Maybe," Anthea allowed. "Good night, my love. I'll see you in the morning."